This is a UK Carcast podcast.
Hello and welcome to UK Carcast, a podcast by non-sport trading car collectors for non-sport trading car collectors. I'm your host Paul Bynes and this is episode 56. The Hover! The Hover! Hello and welcome to the last episode of 2013. In this episode I talked to Harris Tozer about the recent memorabilia show in Birmingham and to Kurt Kirsteiner of Monsterworks about a couple of new sets he's got in the works. Couple of apologies in advance. I might sound a little croaky in the interviews. This is because I was just getting over a bit of a heavy cold and didn't quite have the voice, but wanted to make sure I recorded something before the end of the year. The interview with Kurt Kirsteiner was conducted over a telephone line, so consequently the sound quality isn't all that brilliant, but it is listenable. I think you can very clearly make out what Kurt is saying, so hopefully you'll get a lot out of that. It's a fascinating set that he's talking about, so I really do hope you'll take the time to listen to it. Without further ado, here's Harris. Well, it's been a couple of weeks now since memorabilia, and as you can probably tell by my voice, I've managed to catch the con crud, so I will be speaking as little as possible in the upcoming interview. I didn't record anything at memorabilia this year, mainly because I was only really there for by the time you take into account travelling time, about half a day. But I did manage to hang out with a whole load of people. Someone who was there for the whole weekend and with whom I hung out on Sunday was Harris Tozer, production manager of Non-Sport Update magazine, who was at memorabilia for his 11th year, and I've got him on now to tell me about all the stuff I missed over the whole weekend. Harris, welcome back to UK Carcast.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
This is your annual dodging the Thanksgiving celebrations trip, though I believe if I've got this correct, you did actually end up getting some sort of Thanksgiving celebration in the end.
Yeah, we did. We flew back on Thanksgiving Day and we got a last minute Thanksgiving celebration in due to thanks to friends of mine, and so that's the first time I've had Thanksgiving in the States in several years anyway.
You can get his turkey and his pumpkin pie. Can you please try and shift it for a slightly earlier weekend so that he can get some Thanksgiving dinner in future? 11 years you've been coming over, Harris. You probably are more familiar with the Birmingham NEC than most people who live in Birmingham. How was the show this year?
The show this year was very good. It was different because it was the first winter show that they've combined with the Comic-Con. They've done that for their spring show before, but this was the first November show they've done it, so there was a ton of people.
Yeah, there were a few more cosplayers. I did notice that. It didn't seem to be a huge number more, but there were quite a few. I suspect that it was the Comic-Con side of things.
Yeah, me too.
I'll be honest with you, I didn't notice anything particularly different about the Comic-Con area. They had a couple of stands there that they were promoting Moshi Monsters, which is a game card type thing, I think. And there were a few more artist stands, and the artist alley was in there. But it didn't seem radically different in content from the main hall. Did you think that was the case?
No, I don't know. I did notice a lot myself. I mean, they had that humongous minion from Despicable Me, and they had that really great Star Wars display of all kinds of things like land speeders and props and things like that. And a lot of different publishers, small publishers, were over there. I did see some, things that we haven't seen before.
Okay. Well, as I say, I was only really there for about half a day, from about midday till close. So I didn't get as much of a chance to wander around the whole thing as you and some of the many other Americans that you brought with you this year had to have a look. So it's exceedingly likely that I missed some stuff.
Yeah, well, I have to say that on Saturday, at one point, they were not letting people in the memorabilia entrance. You needed to go into the Comic-Con entrance. And I really got a good perspective of how crowded it was at that point on Saturday, because I had to walk from the Comic-Con area over to our table, and it was a real fight to get through the crowd. It was almost almost approaching what Comic-Con in San Diego is like, just forcing your way through all kinds of people.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the big thing at Memorabilia is celebrity signings. I suspect the show this year was hit a little by the fact that there was stuff going on elsewhere that weekend.
Right.
There was an artist con going on, Think Bubble, going on elsewhere. And I believe there was some event celebrating some minor TV show anniversary down in London. That possibly hit the attendance. But I know on Sunday there did seem to be a good crowd of people going around. And obviously from what you're saying, Saturday was busy as well.
Yeah, Saturday was very busy.
Yeah. But they did have a few celebrities there. There was a separate section for glamour models, if that's the sort of thing that rings your bell. And there were a few sporting celebrities dotted about and a few people from some of the shows. It seemed to be a lot of the usual stalwarts. I know a lot of the Red Dwarf people were there at some point over the weekend as well. So there was an interesting amount of card content this year. Quite a few stands selling cards this year.
Mm-hmm.
The usual favourites, obviously, Cult Stuff had a very big stand this year.
Yeah, they sure did.
Very well represented. I think they had something like 10. Tables to themselves, half of which were devoted to Cult Stuff and half of which was devoted to their sci-fi memorabilia.
Right. Dealer. They also had a large display of Bridget marketing material too.
Yeah. And we'll come on to Bridget in a moment because there's been some interesting news concerning Bridget and memorabilia, which we'll come to in a tick. But they seem to be doing very good business and they were getting a lot of attention on their cards. And obviously there were a few other card dealers there. I didn't linger with a lot of them, but there were a few people that regular attendees would know, selling some quite decent sets. Cryptozoic seemed to have quite a presence in sets this year. Wasn't so much in the way of the cheaper boxes or the low-priced dump-type boxes. But there were quite a few other odd bits and pieces. Was there anything in particular you noticed as far as cards were concerned?
Nothing really sticks out in my mind. I mean, it was good to have all the, you know, the usual dealers back. It was nice that, you know, we had good placement. A lot of the dealers were right front and center, like the Fernandez brothers were front and center, as was a couple of other dealers over there. So cards were very well represented at the show.
Yeah, and obviously next to you, as is his traditional position, was Paul Hart, who seemed to be doing reasonably
right.
Well over the show.
Uh-huh.
I know Paul obviously concentrates on the vintage collectibles, and that can sometimes be a little quiet memorabilia, but he did seem to be getting quite a few people coming up to the stand, so,
right.
So that made for an interesting show. And of course, we should really touch upon NSU, because you had some innovations and exclusives at the stand this year, didn't you?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we had the two Downton Abbey items, which we were really pushing this year, and then we had a lot of different promos and specials, back issues, books, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. You also had something of a rarity in that you had a 5-card Birds of America set that had been photographed and produced by Cliff Tucker, who was actually present at the stand.
That's right.
For a large part of the weekend. Anybody that's been to Philly will know Cliff and Carol, he's a good lady wife, who both help out at the Philly show.
Right.
And Cliff is usually the man responsible for a lot of the photographs that get posted up on Card Talk from the show.
Right.
And appear in a magazine. He's a fantastic photographer.
He sure is.
And of course, he's had his own little 5-card set of birds that's benefiting a couple of wildlife charities in America.
Right.
I picked up a set while I was there and had the cheek to get him to sign one of the cards. They were reasonably priced, and considering they're for a charity and a very limited set, they seem to be doing quite well. Did he do quite well with those?
Yeah, he sold a few of those, you know, he didn't bring a ton over, but he did sell a few of those, and it's nice because 100% of the profits of those are gone to the two wildlife charities. And he's, you know, he's hoping to do more sets beyond other natural life kind of things, but beyond birds.
Of course, Cliff and Carol weren't the only Americans over for the show. We also had Batman, who came over for the show for his second year.
That's right. Yeah, he really enjoys the show, and he enjoyed it again this year. And I hear all things being the same, he's expecting to come back next year too.
And he won't be the only one. The American presence at Memorabilia seems to be increasing in leaps and bounds, because if Car Talk is anything to go by, posts on Car Talk are anything to go by, Tom Breyer, the Brighton, is going to be coming over next year, which should be good fun.
That's what we hear, and I hope he does come over.
It's looking like there's going to be a sizable card contingent, because I know Cold Stuff is looking to expand on their already expansive presence at the show this year, and I believe Tom may be part of that, or at least going somewhere close to it. So the Cult Stuff have some exciting plans for that. And of course, Cult Stuff were dishing out tons of promos. And I've got a few promo packs that they were dishing out that I'll be offering in some form or other over the next few months on UK Cardcast. Cliff was selling his wildlife cards at your stand, but he wasn't the only person selling things at your stand. Obviously, NSU were. So you had some interesting exclusives going on at the show. You always get a good crowd turning up specifically to see you, it seems. They come up to the show just to meet Harris Tozer, the infamous Harris Tozer, and to renew their subscriptions. So how was the show for you this year?
I don't know about that last part there. I think they come to the show to renew their subscriptions and see what's going on. The show was good. We had a really good show. Our variant issue sold pretty well. It wasn't quite as good as the bond issue last year, but overall it was good, and it was a very successful show for us. And I really appreciate how good UK collectors are to us.
Yeah, that bond issue last year was always going to be a tough act to follow.
Right.
I think Downton did well enough, considering it's a slightly unusual subject for a set.
Yeah, it is.
But again, it was a short print run, so it is rare. And I believe if anybody wasn't able to get to Memorabilia, they can pick up copies direct from the NSU website. So worth having a look out for that.
Right.
And of course, you did the Downton metal card as well.
That's
didn't you?
Right. We did the Downton metal card. We did 100 of those and 300 of the variant issues. And the metal cards, we honestly have like 3 or 4 of them left. Maybe by the time the podcast comes out, they may be gone, or there might still be a couple. But we do have a good supply of the variant issues, if anyone's interested.
And I should say that, of course, Carol Tucker, who was also over with Cliff, played an important part in that Downton Abbey issue. She contributed the lead article, didn't she?
Yes, she did. She's a really big Downton Abbey fan, and she's also an Anglophile, and she really loves the Royals, but she especially loves Downton Abbey. And so she was the perfect person to write the story about the Downton Abbey seasons 1 and 2 that Cryptozoic's soon putting out. And
yeah.
It was especially good because we knew she'd be at the show.
Yeah. And I have to say, and anybody playing the drinking game should take a sip now. When I was in Philly a couple of years ago, Carol was absolutely fantastic to talk to. She really made me feel very welcome. And she was grilling me about the royal family.
Mm-hmm.
and all things British. She really is a hardcore Anglophile. It's going to be interesting to see what she comes up with as a show report when she gets back to the US. Because she and Cliff are actually touring around Europe at the moment, and I assume Cliff is using some of this trip to research his next couple of sets. Because he's a fantastic photographer.
I
have a feeling he's going to be doing some wildlife of Iceland as we speak.
Yeah, right.
You had a piece of history, a piece of NSU history on the stand, guys. I picked up a copy of it. You had Volume 1, Issue 1 there.
That's right. We had we have a case that we've unearthed during our consolidation of back issues of Volume 1, Number 1 that we've been selling. We were selling them for £10 at the show. And it's really interesting just to see what the market was like in 1990.
Yeah, it made fascinating reading. I had quite a long train trip home after the show on the Sunday evening. So I was flicking through the magazine, and it was fascinating to see not so much what's changed, but more what has stayed the same.
Yeah.
In the hobby, there's still people grousing about dumped imported product.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of stuff like that, and the shows that you can get sets for, and the fact that there are small companies with art sets. And
I tell you one thing that has changed, though, is the companies. Not many of those companies from that original 1990 book are around these days, maybe except for Tops.
Yeah, certainly not in the same form that they were back then.
Now some of the players are still the same. They're working at other companies and things, but the only companies that I can think of off the top of my head that were around back then were Tops and Upper Deck had just started at that point.
Yeah, so I believe you still do have a couple of copies of that.
Yeah, that's offered on the website for $15, and if you're in the U.S., it's $15 with free shipping, or if you're overseas, it's $15 and inexpensive shipping.
Relatively
inexpensive. Yeah, well, I think it's been reduced, so it's only $3 now.
Oh, that's not too bad. That's quite reasonable in that case, yeah.
Yeah, it's free in the U.S. and $3 for Canada and overseas, I believe.
Yeah. Now, there's no promos in that very first issue.
Well, there were barely any promos in existence at that time.
No, it's worth having a look at, and it's very much worth having a look at the price guide, which is about six pages.
Yeah. That's when sets were quite easy, you know. They had 66 cards and 11 stickers. We had no other inserts, just stickers.
Yeah, so it's absolutely fantastic. So overall, Harris, I mean, considering that Memorabilia was up against a couple of quite big and quite exciting shows elsewhere, uh-huh. in particular the Doctor Who show in London,
right.
It seemed to do quite well.
Yeah, I would say it was a good show for them overall. I mean, I heard 30,000 people. I don't know if that's true or not, but I've heard 30,000 people came through the door. Again, it's unsubstantiated. But it was worth it for us, and definitely makes us want to come back again next year, and I'm sure we will.
Yeah, well, here's to visit number 12 by Harris Dozer and the NSU team.
Yep, have to come up with another variant cover for next year.
Well, we all know what we'd like it to be, but I suspect the BBC isn't going to let you do it just yet.
I don't know. Seems like maybe they're doing their own cards this year.
Well, they do seem to be. I mean, Tops are doing the Match Attacks cards, which seem to be doing very well.
Right.
If the fact that you can't find them anywhere is to be believed, they've sold out pretty quickly. But before we started recording, you did mention that, and this is possibly only in the US Blu-ray edition of the 50th anniversary episode, there seems to be some trading cards in there.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't know whether they're in the UK version because I haven't bought it yet.
No one seems to know that yet. I guess we won't know here for the next couple of days till people start receiving their editions.
I mean, if they are just regular trading cards rather than the game cards that you get in, like Match Attacks, that'll be the first official Doctor Who trading cards in some years.
Yeah, it will be.
So it'll be interesting to see what those are and whether they're a portent for more.
Yeah, one of the Card Talk members, I don't know if he has heard or he speculated, but he has said that it's one card for each Doctor except for the new Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So,
they haven't released the costume details for the new Doctor, so it's unlikely there's going to be an
image
of him.
What would be interesting to see is if you get all Doctors in one pack, or if there are multiple packs and you need to, you know, collect different Blu-rays to get all the Doctors. I don't know.
That has been done in the past, hasn't it? I believe I can't remember which.
Yeah, it would be an expensive set to collect if that's the case. If you have to spend, you know, $20 or $25 a pop to get 6 or 8 cards or whatever, however they would do it.
Yeah. I think they need to do that in VHS. I think Babylon 5 in the UK had a card in each.
Yeah, sure, would be nice if you got them all, but we'll wait and see. We'll wait and see if that's the case.
Okay. Well, Harris, thank you again for coming over to Memorabilia this year. Yeah, you and I did meet up after the show and had a great fun wandering around London and sightseeing. So, and if anybody's on Facebook and follows either me or Harris, you'll find pictures from the various trips that Harris did to London, because I know you went up to London with the Tookers and with Batman and with Kevin Graham.
Yeah, and I should also say, for any of the UK listeners out there, I do really appreciate, you know, everyone who came out to the show and visited the stand. You know, everybody has been very good to us over the years, and we do appreciate it.
Well, while you continue coming over and doing us interesting deals, we'll always be pleased to welcome you, Harris.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
And we're gradually turning Harris into a Brit. It's become something of a custom for him to have fish and chips somewhere.
Well, yeah, it's always interesting to see how many times we eat fish and chips. Sometimes it's, you know, 3-4 times a trip.
Well, yeah, hey, you can't go too far wrong with fish and chips.
No, you can't. Well, no, some places do a better job with it than others.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, it's fish. What can you do? So, but anyway, hopefully next time I talk to you will be for our annual roundup of the year.
Right, that'll be good.
I know you're in – this is only a very short interview because you're in the middle of prepping or finalizing the next issue, which
right.
we won't talk about just now. We'll talk about it a little later on when you come onto the show next time.
Okay.
In the meantime, Harris, thank you once again.
Thank you very much.
And if I don't speak to you before, have a happy new year.
Okay, same to you.
Thank you. I've been speaking to Harris Tozer, production manager of Nonsport Update magazine, and you can find more information about Nonsport Update magazine at their website, which is nonsportupdate.com. Well, that was Harris Tozer, and my thanks to Harris for his continued support of UK Carcast this year. Now, Kurt Kirsteiner of Monster Wax. It's always an absolute pleasure to welcome a friend back to the podcast, and in this particular instance, it's a very old friend who's been supportive of UK Carcast ever since we started. He's a wonderful card manufacturer with ghoulish delights in every set, and I have a feeling his latest set is no exception to that. I'd like to welcome Kurt Kirsteiner of Monster Wax back to UK Carcast. Kurt, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me, Paul.
It's always a pleasure to have you on. I know whenever I've chatted to you before, we usually spend about sort of 2 or 3 hours chatting, and then at some point I remember to put the record button on, because we always find sort of all sorts of interesting subjects to chat about, and this one is going to be no exception. You've got a new set that you're in the process of finalizing at the moment. That should be out fairly soon. Do you want to spill the beans on that one?
Sure. It was actually, we were trying to get it out in time for Christmas, and it's going to be close. It may be a little bit after that, but I think it's going to be well worth the wait. It's a series we've been working on for quite a long time on H.P. Lovecraft, the famous pulp horror writer of the 1930s, who pretty much made and established Weird Tales, a magazine at that time that was the go-to magazine for cosmic horror, in which H.P. Lovecraft specialized in.
Yeah. Now, Lovecraft is one of those names that if you're in the know, you'll know about him. Otherwise, you won't necessarily know the name, but you'll be aware of some of the stuff that he did, because his work has influenced horror and TV and film and theatre and all sorts of stuff ever since. You can see traces of Lovecraft in practically everything that's dark or spooky.
Yeah, his name is it's become an adjective. You know, you could say it's Lovecraftian. You see a creature with tentacles on its mouth or something. Oh, that's a very Lovecraftian creature. And he has sort of personified that decadence, the decaying, atmospheric New England rundown look that, you know, people would give a lot of their horror stories, whether it was in New England or not. And if you remember Edgar Allan Poe in The Fall of the House of Usher, he sort of took that idea and went to the next level. And, you know, it's the family that's just run its course, or the culture that's run its course, and now it's on the downswing, and the terrible things that can happen when these over-analytical types start to question their own sanity. And the answer, of course, is always, yes, you are very insane.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly the classic pulp author, really, Lovecraft. I mean, Edgar Allan Poe, as you mentioned there, is now regarded as one of the classics of literature, let alone of horror literature. But Lovecraft, as you said, took it on, and is certainly worthy of being ranked up there in the literary classics, though he does tend to be regarded as, oh, he's just a pulp author or a horror author, and it's really very much of a cult figure.
Well, a lot of, generally speaking, in academic circles, Edgar Allan Poe and Lovecraft are considered sort of the binary fathers of horror. And Lovecraft is gets a lot of credit for what's called cosmic horror because he brought in the notion of alien influences and brought the science fiction element into horror in a very believable way. And it's funny because Edgar Allan Poe actually perpetrated a hoax on the American public back in the around Civil War times in the 1800s. Where he wrote an article about the people who do telescopes, astronomers, seeing life on Mars. And he described all these Martians that they saw, and he perpetrated this, sending it to, I think it was the Boston newspaper, and they ran with it, and then all the other newspapers started duplicating this article. So people don't give Edgar Allan Poe any credit for science fiction, but he actually did this incredible hoax on the American public, and for like 3 days, everyone was convinced there was life on Mars because of this fake article that Poe had sent in.
Yeah.
It's sort of funny that H.P. Lovecraft actually, again, picked up on Poe's following pioneer footsteps and carried that to the next level.
Yeah, that's the thing. And then obviously H.G. Wells picked up from there as H.G. Wells picked up and Orson Welles picked up from that and all sorts of stuff spun out of those original ideas.
They were all reading one another because, it wasn't like today where there's so many different cable news networks and there's the Internet and then there's Netflix and, just all these different avenues where you can spend an entire lifetime on one particular format that no one else that you know actually shares. This is back, like when I was growing up, there was only, one TV network in town, CBS. That was the only TV station we had. And if anybody saw anything on TV last night, you all saw the same thing. And that's sort of how it was back in literature back then. There wasn't a whole lot of different games in town. There was only one newspaper in town. There was no radio stations. There were no television stations. Everybody was on the same page. And if you were good, everybody knew about it.
Yeah.
So if you read pulp magazines back then, everybody knew about Weird Tales that was into that type of mystery and horror.
Sure.
And so they all knew who Lovecraft was. Everybody knew about Edgar Allan Poe back when he was famous. He'd walk down the street and kids would follow him and he would whip around and he'd go, "Nevermore." They'd all jump back and then they'd just continue to follow him like in this big gaggle. He was a rock star.
Yeah.
But H.P. Lovecraft, he was he never got to that level. People knew who he was, but he was a recluse and nobody recognized him in public at all.
No, that's the thing is, I suspect is he did get sort of sidelined into a niche as far as reputation is concerned. Oh, he's just that guy who, he never really hit the mainstream as well as Poe did, or indeed as much as British authors like M.R. James.
I always see people make comments about him, like in Wikipedia and in other areas, where they always say he was a great author. He was never really appreciated because he didn't know how to promote himself, and he didn't have the confidence to promote himself. And I can't help but ask myself, is this one of those things where we apply today's standards to yesterday's people? Like when they say, "Well, George Washington, he was a great person, but he had slaves." Well, newsflash, everyone had slaves back then.
Exactly.
That's just the reality. You can't put today's situation, impose that on somebody from 200 years ago. And likewise, H.P. Lovecraft didn't have social media. He didn't have Facebook. What was he supposed to do? Buy billboards and say, "Read Lovecraft," or put out newspaper ads? That takes a lot of money.
Yeah.
So, back then, you really were sort of at the mercy of what just caught on and what didn't catch on. And, horror was sort of this little outbound little hobby of people. A lot of them were adolescents. A lot of them were male. A lot of them were not family people. They almost had a little bit of a bad reputation.
Mm.
So it's not surprising that he was left out of the norm, even though he's a fantastic writer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he concentrated his energies into creating such fantastic stories. And it's entirely as a result of that that so many people have been influenced to this day.
Well, not just by his writings, Paul, but also by his letters. H.P. Lovecraft was the singular greatest man of letters in all of America. He wrote over 100,000 letters, and 20,000 of them survive today. That ranks him up there with Voltaire, basically the greatest letter writer of all time.
Mm.
How this fellow managed to actually write novels or books or short stories is, I don't even understand how he had a chance to do that and eat, because he was so busy writing constantly.
Well, yeah, it is amazing the amount of stuff he did actually produce. It's absolutely staggering. And now you have produced a set devoted entirely to him and his various works. So what's the details on the set, Kurt?
Well, basically, we have one painter who's Ricardo Guerrero Jr., that is Ricardo Sr.'s son, who did some chase cards for us for his father's last series. And, he wanted to do something with Lovecraft, and I said, well, sure, based on what I saw, what you did on your inserts, this would be a lot of fun. Well, he went with a different style, and it turns out that this style is really amazing. I just love the way he is able to bring to life these images that are, at least we're told scientifically, are impossible. But you look at them and they look real. They look believable. The atmosphere is all there. He's just does wonderful interpretations of Lovecraft work. Sometimes he'll have a little bit of a creative license, like Herbert West. Might be a blonde in the Lovecraft story, and he might make him this sinister bald fellow. But you can see why he would take it to that next little angle on the person's interpretation, just because that's where Wes sort of physically is. Even in a mental sense, he's this cruel person when you get right down to it.
Yeah.
So some purists may nitpick on a couple of the finer details. But, Hollywood's been doing that for years.
Mm.
There's all these famous scenes in the movies that didn't partake in the stories. Well, what Ricardo does is he kind of modernizes a few of these things. And I have to appreciate what he does in that regard.
He has his own particular take on certain elements, which is artistic license, and it's perfectly acceptable in anything, really.
Well, he's done this entire 66 card base set, and it's just short of amazing how he was able to each story make it like his best one. You know,
yeah.
A lot of times you don't want to have one artist do a whole bunch, because you have to kind of pick and choose what their best stuff is. But in this particular instance, every day I would open up one of it. Not, he doesn't crank out one a day, but every time I would open up one of his paintings, I'd keep thinking, oh, this is the best one.
And then, yeah.
The next one, oh, no, this is the best one. And it just kept getting better and better. So it's been a delight to watch him work. And it's one of my favorite sets in the 90s was one Joe Jusko did with Marvel Masterpieces.
Mm-hmm.
He did the entire series. And I was always very impressed with that series. And I thought that was the best Marvel Masterpieces series they ever did.
Mm.
You know, even though they had all these great artists work on different sets, with that particular one, he really did the best of all the Marvel Masterpieces series.
Yeah.
So, more is not usually better in my estimation. Also, the styles tend to clash when you bring in, a whole bunch of different people.
Yeah. And you've got you've got a uniform style across this. And of course this fits in with what Monster Wax has pretty much become known for, which is a story on a card. It's the complete package. One card in the base set is pretty much there. You've got a fantastic illustration on the front, and you've got some fantastic text on the back. And these are the sort of things that make base cards. the important part of a set, which is something that I think a lot of newer collectors of more modern sets don't necessarily realize or haven't experienced.
Well, Paul, it may be an anathema for you or me, but I know people who I like. These are nice people, and they're car collectors, very serious car collectors, but they never, ever read the backs. Mm. And they'll tell you this. You'll say, well, did you ever, what do you think of this or that card? You know, well, I didn't read it, but I thought the front was really good. You didn't read it? You know, isn't that kind of like buying a book for the cover and not reading the contents?
Yeah.
You know, to me, I mean, maybe my math is off here, but it seems like the back is 50% of the card.
Well, exactly.
And if the front is really compelling, the very first thing that I want to do is flip over the back and find out what, you know, it is on the front that I'm looking at. Now, a lot of times I'm extremely disappointed in that. You know, I'll flip it over and I'll think, oh, man, this is a cool picture. What is that guy doing? And I flip it over and the back says, I chose a combination of muted colors for this particular painting. I thought I might, you know, I thought, wait a minute, I don't want to know how you painted it. I want to know about the story, about what's going on the front.
Exactly.
And if it's a compelling image, it's usually a compelling story. And certainly that is the case in this particular series. The stories are tremendously compelling. They are what inspired the image, and the image is the actual moment of impact or climax of the story, or one of the many moment of impacts in the story. And I don't do any commentary on the back. It's not what I think about Lovecraft. It's not what an expert thinks about Lovecraft. It's what Lovecraft thinks about his story. It is that moment that he is describing in the story where there's some sort of revelation or some sort of dramatic event, and you're seeing his words unedited, and you know, just it really draws you in. And I'm hoping people will see these images and will read just that one or two paragraphs on the back, and will find themselves bitten by the Lovecraft addiction. Because I couldn't even, for me, this series was extremely time-consuming to do, because it's constantly, you find yourself being drawn into these stories and wanting to read more and more and more and going back and rereading them. And we have a very visually oriented society today. People are moving away from books. They're getting away from anything that takes any amount of time where they're just not being visually stimulated. And a lot of people haven't gotten the basics of great reading.
Yeah.
And sadly, that means their imaginations aren't being activated. Well, Lovecraft uses the imagination more than just about anyone else.
Yeah.
So if you can actually see that imagination drawn out in a picture and then see the image and actually be sort of forced to see his vision in words, I think it's going to be very hard to just walk away from that and not want to pick up one of those books and read a little bit.
Yeah, and you've made it slightly easier in a way for people to do that, because of course you're on the MonsterWax website, which is monsterwax.com. In addition to all the details to the set, I think we were chatting before I hit the record button. You've actually got links to some of the stories.
Yeah, not some of them, all of them.
Every
single story on that card set, in that card set, is linked to, and you can actually read the story before you read the card. Or what will most likely happen, people will see the card, they'll have interest in it, and then they'll want to read the story. Yeah, go to your library, get the book. But if you're lazy or don't have the time to do that, by all means, go to our website and read it for free there.
Yeah.
It's some of these stories are very, very short. Some of them are medium length. Very, very few of them are long. In fact, I mentioned his novels. He never really did a novel. He did more like novelettas. He did that At the Mountains of Madness, which is not a novel by any sense of the word, but it is it's a pretty long story. It's been an hour and a half shivering in bed.
Yeah, sorry?
Because it's the prototype for all those great classic horror stories that take place on the North Pole or in Antarctica.
Ah.
The Thing, or any of these other tales where it's basically a group shut off from the rest of society, and their numbers are being picked off one by one by some horrible alien menace.
Yeah, and you never see the alien menace, but you get that increasing sense of creeping dread.
Yeah, and where are you going to go? I mean, you're surrounded by sub-zero temperatures.
Exactly.
It's the epitome of a chiller.
it fits perfectly with some of your previous releases, because you do have a tendency at Monster Wax to go for the chill.
You know, as a matter of fact, Paul, I should mention that we Friday the 13th came up just last week, and you know, it's the beginning of winter, and we decided we were going to have a little bit of fun with this, so we started what we called the Lovecraft Chill of the Week Club, and what we're doing through our Facebook page and through our website and on all the forums is we're inviting people to read a specific Lovecraft story, a different one each week, and then discuss it on the Facebook page and stuff. And it may only be one or two people, it may be dozens of people, but I guarantee you, if they go and read these stories, it's a lot of fun to talk about them after the fact, because there's so much depth in all of everything that Lovecraft does. I mean, you can read, I guarantee you read a Lovecraft story once, twice, three times, you're going to get three different things out of that story. I don't know how many times you can read it and get find out something new and different, but at least three times. I mean, there's that much material and density in his writing. He really thinks the stuff through. And I'm looking forward to people's thoughts on that, because there's so much there. Every time I talk about it, and every time I read it, and every time I think about it, there's just more and more than meets the eye with this writer. It's just as stunning.
Yeah.
So now we invite people to do that.
Yeah, please do. I mean, it's the modern incarnation of a book club, but it's about one author and it's about all of his stories. So it's always great to get discussion going on things like that.
Yeah, it's only going to be for the winter, you know, but that's a perfect time to do it, because especially you being over there in England, you're probably more aware than most that it's a traditional time for ghost stories.
Exactly. Yeah, it wouldn't be a Christmas in the UK if M.R. James' ghost stories or somebody's ghost stories weren't being aired on the TV or on the radio. So, and I think this year is no exception. We have a few of those coming around. So, we've already stressed the importance of the base set, and obviously 66 card base set. But you do have some little bonus extras and chases and things in there as well, don't you?
Oh, yes. Well, one of the things we're having a lot of fun with is the Necronomicon cards. There's two of them in this series. One of them is a prismatic one of Abdul Azarad, which is a character who wrote the Necronomicon card, or Necronomicon. And he's featured in a prismatic card, which is in every alternating box. And then in every box is a lenticular one of Cthulhu, which, of course, is one of Lovecraft's most famous characters. And this is, in my humble opinion, one of the most beautiful lenticular cards of all time. Mm. It's a wonderful Necronomicon card to include. And I think no H.P. Lovecraft collection will be complete without it. So that's a lot of fun. We also have what's called sacred souvenir cards, and those involve certain objects that were used in his stories, like essential salts and the color out of space slime and things of that nature. So those are sort of Lovecraftian relics, and those are included at a complete set in every box. We try to have very good collation in all our boxes, because the feeling is with only 500 boxes produced, you don't need to, you know, create an artificial scarcity. I mean, it's already only 500 of the sets possible. So we don't try to hold back on that. And then, of course, there's these beautiful original artist sketch cards, which involve a wonderful assortment of great artists in the horror realm, not the least of which was Neil Camera, who did stuff with us before Spook Show, Anthony Carpenter, Sean Kahn, Ted Dastic, and, of course, Matthew Kirsch. You know, these people have been doing a lot of the wacky horror-related cards as well. Chris Ballone helped us with another beautiful insert set. This is a six-card foil series, Fright Foils is what we call them, focusing on the mythical monsters, the most famous of the mythical monsters that Lovecraft used. And that's a part about Lovecraft that's a lot of fun to talk about in these get-togethers of Lovecraft fans, because he doesn't just come up with a monster in one story and then come up with a different monster the next one. These are recurring characters that kind of pop up again and again, and you learn more about them as you read more and more Lovecraft stories. Hmm. And Cthulhu, of course, is the most famous, but there's all these oddball ones, too. And yeah. then we have a Jason Crosby, Mark Finneral, Chuck the Hun, and Christopher West, who have joined up specifically for this series. Their artwork has just been doing amazing things on eBay or whatnot, but what really attracted us was their tendency to have this Lovecraftian style. So everybody involved is familiar with and a fan of Lovecraft, so it's really been a fun group project to have them included.
It sounds like a fantastic set. As regular listeners will know, I have an interest in this area of literature. I have form. and that's why it's always a pleasure to have you onto the show, because you and I both share an interest in that sort of thing. And in the old-time radio shows, such as Quiet Please.
Well, you always kind of feel a little bit like it's a guilty pleasure, and you have to justify it and, you know, point out, well, you know, I'm not a sadistic serial murderer just because I enjoy reading about horror.
Exactly.
But
I've got a reputation outside of the podcast for being quite a nice person, and I keep telling people, I'm not as nice as you think.
Well, you know, I equate it to enjoying roller coaster rides. You know, just because you enjoy roller coaster rides doesn't mean that you're a reckless driver. You know,
exactly.
It's just fun. Yeah.
Which is what it should be. I mean, in moderation, anything can be fun. And horror and spooky stories and the macabre should always be fun.
Oh, yeah. You know, you walk around my house, you're not going to see all these altars to Satan or anything like that. It's more of a escape and vent from reality than it is a pursuit to actually want to see these types of things. You know, for me, I draw the line on – I love the fantasy element. You know, I like monster stories because I know that they're fantasy. I don't like – the new wave of movies that deal with, you know, just sadistic killers, you know, Saw and stuff like that, you know, where somebody chops off your arm, or, let's play a game, you know, and it's just somebody being cruel to someone else. And the reason being is because that's a little too close to reality for me. There are people who are crazy. There are people who are murderers. But I don't really worry on a day-to-day basis about me being hurt or anybody in my family being hurt as a result of space aliens or as a result of werewolves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so some of the newer stuff is a wee bit too graphic for my liking. It doesn't leave anything to the imagination, and that surely is the whole point of horror, is the imagination. It's you imagining what could happen, not will happen, what could happen if... and so on and so forth. And that's why a lot of these original pulp stories and classic novels and classic short stories work so well, because they don't go into the full detail. They leave your mind to fill in the gaps and work out what's going to happen or what happened or what these things look like.
And when it's all said and done and you come back to the real world, you look out over the landscape and you kind of take a sigh of relief and you say, you know what, life isn't so bad. This isn't a really bad planet. It could be worse. I was just reading a story where it was much worse. You know?
Exactly.
Whereas when you watch something like the, you know, the slasher films and everything, there's always that little pause and you think, unfortunately there are some people who are like that, but they're not as many as they are in the movie, you know, and it's guarded.
Thankfully. Very glad for that as well. So now, you said earlier you're doing 500 boxes of this, and they're all available from the Monster X website. And I know you're aiming to get some of this stuff out for Christmas, so if people want to get their orders in now, it probably would be a really good time to do so.
Oh, yeah. Well, we know that you never see a whole lot of our stuff up on eBay. Fact of the matter is, when people get it, they keep it. So if you want it, you know, don't sit around and wait for it to come up on the secondhand market, because you're gonna more than likely be disappointed. It's a backhanded compliment to us. I mean, we appreciate it, but at the same time, it does mean that, you know, we don't get the exposure that we might otherwise do. That's just the side effect of creating products that don't get dumped. I mean, one advantage of having dumping is that everybody sees your product. It's everywhere because it's being dumped. But we're making this stuff to be collected and kept by the collectors, and I'm proud and happy to say that for the most part, that's exactly what they're doing. And we make this stuff to last. That's why we only do one or two series a year. We're not into the quantity business. We're into the quality business.
Exactly. So, and if anyone wants more information on that set, monsterwax.com is the place to go. You mentioned you only do one or two sets. Now, you've got this one pretty much close to going out. So are you already working on your new next set?
Well, you know, the logistics of producing low mintage sets is that you pretty much do have to gang up all your products. It's the only way you can afford to keep the price down and still do low limited edition items. And we try to keep all our products now at 24-pack boxes at under $50. And it's been a real challenge because we keep cramming more and more stuff into them. But nonetheless, we are on the next project, and I'm happy to say that that's going to be a fun series too. And a little bit, it falls into a quasi in-between space of what we were just talking about, the fantasy versus reality. The subject is dinosaurs. It's a series called Dinosaur Galaxy, and it's going to be about the great monsters of the past. And the reason it's in that quasi area is because it is real.
Yeah.
Fortunately, we are spared the terror of the dinosaurs simply because of our chronological place on this planet. We happen to come at the time after their reign. And their reign lasted 10 times longer than the reign of humans. Actually, it lasted 100 times longer. They're estimated to have been around for 300 million years, and the humans have only been around for 3 million years. So it's almost a little mind-bending to realize that if people were to describe this planet based on what has made the biggest mark on the planet, it would have to be called the dinosaur planet, because that's what it was for so long. And if probably humans never would have evolved if the dinosaurs hadn't have become extinct. They were such an incredibly dangerous and violent and a destructive force to have in the neighborhood. How could you ever have evolved into a civilization or a village or have a culture with those things, those giant behemoths running around eating you at every opportunity?
Oh, exactly. I mean, they evolved from the smallest creatures to the largest over their 300 odd million years. And it was only really because of, according to various scientific theories, asteroids or volcanoes or whatever that erupting, that they disappeared and gave those tiny little tree voles the chance to evolve into man. Otherwise, Lord knows where we'd be. We'd have sentient thinking dinosaurs, probably.
Well, you know, I like to remind myself that the whole bit with dinosaurs is a case study in the limitations of our own knowledge. And because in my own short lifespan, when I was growing up, I was told with scientific certainty that dinosaurs were cold-blooded and they were slow and lethargic, and that they died because of an ice age, and that ice age was coming again, and that we could expect it in the next 10,000 years and it would destroy humanity in the same way. And, you know, we were tested on these questions, and if you didn't recite the same answer back to them, you were wrong. You were the fool, and you had to wear the dunce cap. Well, you go forward 20 years, and now suddenly all that stuff is turned on its head. The dinosaurs were warm-blooded. They were fast. They had feathers. They were descended from birds. Oh, and by the way, it's not an ice age that's going to kill us. It's going to be global warming. You know?
Yeah.
So you just can't trust whatever the scientists say is 100% certain. They're oftentimes wrong. And we really don't know what killed the dinosaurs, but we can definitely be thankful from our own selfish standpoint that they're not around, while at the same time still admire just the majesty and the incredible power that these creatures had.
Yeah, so what's the timeline on the set? When are you planning to bring that one to collectors?
We're currently scheduling that for May.
Ah, okay.
And we have a lot of artists who are actually secret dinosaur admirers too. So this has been percolating for some time.
So I imagine. I mean, that's the thing with a set covering creatures so massive. You need to have an intensive process of working on that one. It looks like it's going to be an interesting set. I don't think there's anybody alive that can't have had an interest in dinosaurs at some point in their life.
Reminded about how you really couldn't have dreamed up something that incredible. I mean, if you were to try to come up with a science fiction story about a weird planet where you would land on, and it's just the most amazing planet. You know, these giant lizard creatures that eat people, you know, they're in all shapes and sizes. You couldn't come up with something better than that. And it happened. And it happened for a long time. And it happened here. And who knows? Maybe it happened on other planets. We don't know. But we know it happened here. And it just shows that fact is stranger than fiction.
Exactly.
And it's amazing that for most of the time that we were around, we didn't even know about dinosaurs. They just kind of stumbled across some of their bones, and they thought they were dragons for the longest time.
Yep.
But for the last several hundred years, it was a hobby that grew into a science, and it has completely changed our understanding about how old the Earth was. Prior to that time, people determined that, the world was 6,000 years old, because you just count back the number of years of the people who were described in the Bible all the way back to Adam, and you come up with 6,000 years. You know?
Exactly. That's the famous line that Bishop Usher came up with, was working that one out, which, given the knowledge at his time, was probably understandable. But, So, okay, so we have to look. Hopefully, we'll have you back on in May to talk about that set when you've finalised it and you've got the boxes ready to go. But in the meantime, if people want to pick up a Monster Wax set, H.P. Lovecraft is the one to go for, and that's on the monsterwax.com website now. As ever, Kurt, thank you for coming on to UK Carcast. It is always a sheer joy for me to talk to you, because we have so much in interest, so many interests in common, and we always invariably spend ages chatting about them.
Well, I want to invite you, Paul, and all your listeners to join in on the fray anytime they have a spare moment, to go to the Facebook and discuss their memories and thoughts on these various Lovecraft stories, because, as I say, we're going to be bringing a different one up every week, and we want to just have fun with this. I mean, there's certainly no purchase expected or imposed on anyone. It's all absolutely free, and if nothing else, you can just get your Lovecraft thrill on and have a little bit of fun with the winter tales of spookdom.
Okay. I'd strongly recommend people do that, and I will make sure that there are links on the UK Carcast website. Kurt, again, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, and have a very Merry Christmas.
And to you, sir, and to you. I've been speaking to Kurt Kirsteiner of Monster Wax, and you can find more information about Monster Wax at their website, which is monsterwax.com. Again, my thanks to Kurt for agreeing to come on to UK Carcast. Links to the Facebook discussion that he mentioned in that interview will be on the UK Carcast website by the time this episode goes online. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank everybody who's participated in UK Carcast this year, and indeed in the years previously, and to you, the listeners, for your continued support. Truly touching to know that there are people out there who actually enjoy these inane witterings that I put out from time to time.
hopefully they're of interest or of use to you in discuss some of the new sets that are coming up. If you've got suggestions for things we could discuss in the next episodes coming up in 2014, please do get in touch. The email address is ukcarcast@googlemail.com, though I think ukcarcast@gmail.com also works now. You can find us on Facebook. We've got a group there. Do a search for UK Carcast, and we're on Twitter which is at UK Carcast. I have got some interesting interviews lined up for the first couple of episodes of the new year, but I'm always interested in getting interviews with anybody of interest to fellow car collectors, so please do get in touch if you'd like to participate next year. UK Carcast is released under a Creative Commons licence. For more information about the Creative Commons licence, please visit our website at carcast.co.uk. That's it for 2013. I'm off on holidays now, so things may go a little quiet for me for a couple of weeks. But for those of you who celebrate Christmas, may you have a happy and peaceful Christmas. For those of you who celebrate anything else, be it Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or any of the other celebrations that are going on, like Yule, please do enjoy those. Have a happy and peaceful time regardless, and have a very happy new year. And remember, one pack is not enough. Even if someone gave it to you as a present.